From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Prentice Penny was climbing the ladder as a TV writer when his mom told him about the career moves of one of their old neighbors, Issa Rae.
When my mom called me Prenny, she'd be like, Prenny, I just read this article about this black girl who grew up in View Park who's making this web series and this book and blah, blah, her name's Issa Rae. And my mom always thinks I know everybody, so she's like, do you know her?
Penny got to know Rae, and now he's a multi-hyphenate. He's showrunner of HBO's highly acclaimed, highly addicting, and now Emmy-nominated Insecure. And he's directing films for Netflix with an overall deal at HBO. He tells us about his career path and his call for Hollywood to step representation way up. But first on the News Banter, Disney defies disaster. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my buddy in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So a lot going on in Hollywood. Disney, which you know has been pummeled by the pandemic, announced catastrophic losses. I mean, really a huge number. And yet the market is convinced that Disney has a bright future.
Yeah, only in 2020 media can you lose $4.7 billion in a quarter due to the total shutdown of two of your most profitable businesses, theme parks and movie distribution. And all of a sudden, you throw these streaming numbers in Wall Street's face and your stock goes up. Yes, Disney does have 60 million subscribers to Disney Plus, which is on the low end of their estimates for the first 5 years of the service. And they've done that in 9 months. And when you add in Hulu and ESPN Plus, it gets to about 100 million. That is a pretty impressive number. You know, obviously they're not making a lot of money on streaming, but in this environment, when Netflix is losing billions of dollars to amass this huge amount of subscribers worldwide, that's what the market wants to see, and that's what they were rewarded for.
Well, a lot of the market does see the future in streaming. Disney, you know, they had The Mandalorian when they launched. They launched really well. But there was a sort of a lull with stuff that would attract an older than, you know, very young audience, then that was a problem that Disney, I think, saw coming. I think that may be part of the reason why Bob Iger decided to do this rushed resignation as CEO and say he was turning his attention to content. And you just saw the person who had been developing a lot of the content shift to a job at Condé Nast. So they are realigning there. And they did have Hamilton, and that was big, noisy for them. They charge $7 a month. So when you say they're not raking in the profit yet, but they are gearing up to rake in the profit. Now they're turning to Mulan. And this is a really interesting experiment because Mulan is being put on the service, only on the streaming service, but for $30 as opposed to the $20 that Universal had charged for Trolls, for example. And Universal had made that film available to everyone, and Peacock wasn't really even launched at that point. For Mulan, a $200 million plus movie, I mean, that is a kind of thing that terrifies theater owners because normally a studio has not thought of releasing a film with that budget on premium video on demand. Disney is saying this is a one-off, but at the same time, they're saying we're going to learn a lot from this experiment.
Yeah, I mean, this is a one-off until it isn't. And I think they are probably being sincere in that they had to figure out something to do with this movie because there is no end to this pandemic in sight in the U.S., and they can't hold on to it forever. They will release it in theaters in some foreign markets that don't have Disney+. But the interesting thing here is what Disney is doing with Disney+, the streaming platform. You know, there has been this movement championed by Netflix and HBO Max and a couple of the others to popularize this pay one fee and get all you can watch model for streaming, where, you know, if you are a Netflix subscriber or an HBO Max subscriber, you pay your money and you get it all. There's no upcharges anywhere else. And what Disney is saying here is that they are willing to experiment with an upcharging system, somewhat similar to what Amazon does, where if you go on the Amazon Prime Video interface, there's stuff that's free with your Prime membership, and then there's stuff that you have to pay for, whether it's via other services or just via rentals. Yet Amazon is slightly different because a lot of the people who subscribe to Prime Video are not there for video. They're there because they want the Prime membership that gets you free shipping. And what Disney is doing here is they're essentially creating a paywall behind a paywall to say, okay, yes, you subscribe to Disney Plus, but we're going to get your $30 if you want this premium content. And they're going to see how many people are willing to do that. There is precedent for this kind of a situation. I look at what Disney does with their FastPass app at the parks. If you are a Disney park goer, you can go on their app at Disneyland or Disney World and pay $10 and get the FastPass app that reserves you places in line without having to go there. And that's essentially an upcharge for an extra service within the Disneyland ecosystem. And now this is what they're doing on streaming. They're putting this highly desirable piece of content, cost $200 million to make, has a big fan base, behind this $30 paywall within their own ecosystem. Not only do they not have to share money with a lot of the premium video on demand distributors, but they're able to kind of control every aspect of this rental process, get data, get a lot of information about these subscribers, and see if the money makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, they're building up a system for this, so I can't imagine that it's a one-off, but I will note that Mulan is a hugely recognizable property, and you can't just replicate that.
Well, and their normal way to make their money back is not available. I think everybody agrees that if these Disney movies make $1 billion plus at the theatrical box office, they don't want that to go away. And when the theaters come back, Disney's model, I predict, is going to be to put these $200 million plus movies in theaters. But they can't do that now. And maybe in 10 years, that whole model will shift. And they're planting the flag now to get into that business and figure it out.
Yes. Meanwhile, speaking of figuring it out, an anticipated reorganization at NBC Universal. My colleague Leslie Goldberg and I had reported on big problems at the NBC broadcast network. Toxic culture. The person who oversaw that network, Paul Telegdy, has been reorganized out of the company. They are basically revising their model, and it seems like they're looking to Netflix as a sort of guide as to how they want to run this company at this point.
Traditionally, at these media companies that own multiple different brands and distribution platforms, the development structure is such that if you develop a project at one outlet, it's rare that that project would then shift to another outlet. It does happen, but the model traditionally is if you are USA and you develop a show like Mr. Robot that isn't totally on brand for USA, but might expand that brand or change it, it's going to air on USA. But what Jeff Shell is doing here at NBC Universal is he's taking that vertical development structure and he's basically making it horizontal, where they are going to have a content distribution executive, in this case, Frances Berwick and whoever she hires to be the creative person. They're going to develop a ton of content and then figure out where it goes in the NBC Universal distribution ecosystem, whether it goes to streaming via Peacock, whether it goes to a linear network in broadcast at NBC or cable at USA or Bravo or one of the others. And that's a big change. And I think it's going to cause a lot of people within the creative community to have a lot of questions about where do I pitch? What do I do? What if I develop a show that I think is an NBC show and all of a sudden it ends up on Bravo? You know, there's a lot of questions that they have to work out here.
Yeah, I mean, there's confusion just like there was when, you know, HBO and HBO Max and Warner Media and Warner Brothers were figuring out who makes movies for which area and where do you pitch? And as the industry shifts, this kind of confusion is going to have to be sorted out as the industry undergoes other huge changes. I mean, we haven't even mentioned that ICM made a deal with the Writers Guild and the agency world is shifting as WME figures out if it is signing up, as CAA seems to be balking at signing up. There's a lot going on in this industry, and these reorganizations reflect changing times, but also lead to considerable confusion. We have to see how it sorts itself out. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, former editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. And a postscript. Late last week, WarnerMedia CEO Jason Kilar, still kind of new on the job, shocked the town with a reorganization that moved out top entertainment executives Bob Greenblatt and Kevin Reilly. Warner Brothers chair Ann Sarnoff now oversees all the company's entertainment units with a major expansion of duties for HBO's Casey Bloys. More to come. With every new episode of HBO's Insecure, Twitter lights up. The show follows the lives and many loves of Issa Dee, played by Issa Rae, and her friends Molly, Kelly, and Tiffany, played by Yvonne Orji, Natasha Rothwell, and Amanda Seals. Issa, the character, is a bit adrift in the world, but in the show's fourth season, she started to find a calling in creating events that spotlight the talent of the Black community in her Los Angeles neighborhood. She's also engaged or not in helping her friends with their various struggles. Here, Tiffany vents about the challenge of being a new mom.
They tell you childbirth is this beautiful thing. It's not. It's ugly and it hurts.
Girl, but you look beautiful now.
Yeah, you are glowing, for real.
I haven't showered in 3 days. It's just oil. I'm gross.
Yes, you are. Extremely.
Well, I couldn't even do this without him.
Well, yeah, you can't get yourself pregnant.
Yes, you can. Google it.
I did. It's been so hard. And it turned out I had a blood clot.
Oh, my God.
Are you serious?
Yes.
Girl, these doctors need to start listening to us. That's how they almost killed Serena.
Ooh, can you Yelp review a maternity ward? Because I'm going to give them 3 stars. 3.
Prentice Penny has been an executive producer on Insecure since its first season. He's worked in Hollywood for 15 years, and having climbed that ladder, he's an outspoken advocate for inclusion of Black characters and stories. Earlier this summer, he wrote a column for Deadline about how only 3 Black shows had ever gotten Emmy nominations for Best Comedy Series: Atlanta, Black-ish, and The Cosby Show. Those, only The Cosby Show won. Insecure is now the 4th show to be nominated in that category, but Penny says Hollywood still has a lot of work to do.
That's what I was trying to get to, this idea that how systemic it is. It's like things we don't really even think about anymore, like things that we, you know, it all kind of feeds itself. You know, it's like this show gets heralded as a great show. Other shows don't get looked at. So then that promotes other showrunners to continue to get more shows, which then continues the cycle of, well, I don't need to maybe open myself up diverse wise. And then that show, because of the name, gets more awards. You know what I mean? It's like, that's the process, right? And so, you know, what you just want is like all shows to be looked at, all art to be considered, and not feel like, you know, other thing isn't getting looked at the same way. So I'm glad that we're nominated. I would also hope that the show can just stand on its own merit and not need an article like that or anything else in the world to make people be like, hey, we should like just look at all the things that are made by all artists and not just sort of lock into like what is, I don't say the easiest thing, but the most mainstream thing to identify.
I will note, I can't resist noting that it did win a Peabody.
No, and that's what was so weird. You know, the show has been like, you know, we've been on the AFI, we've been on the TCA, we've been on the Peabody. And so it's been a weird thing. Clearly, you know, the Peabody's in writing and so many other things, but yet we've never get nominated for writing from Golden Globes or Emmys, and we never get nominated from a show. You know what I mean? So I think that's what's been so weird and ironic, or like, wait, what's happening on some front too, you know? But you also don't want to feel like you're like doing it for that, or you feel like you have to bang the window to like get looked at in that way, you know? So that's also the weird thing too.
Yeah, you know, I recently had a call from a Black writer on a show that stars a Black actor. And he was asking me to look at what you're talking about. A white showrunner thinks he's, you know, living a good life and good intentions. And yet what this writer was telling me is somehow the white director writers on the show kept doing a little bit better than the Black writers, or a lot better than that. So that seems to be a part of the picture you're talking about. I don't know if you feel like any sense of optimism. I noticed you in your column, you call for 60% of the crew to be people of color, Black people. And of course, that would be pushing towards not just representation, but kind of reparations, right?
Yeah. And I don't look at it even as like, and I wanted to be clear, I guess, when I was saying that, what I was saying was like all people of color, right? So the Asian, you know, a Latino, Native American, all forms, because even if you went where the show was 60% various people of color, well, that still might just mean that like you can still have, you know, if you have a staff of 10 writers, you might have 2 Black people, you might have, you know, 3 Latino people, you might have 2 Asian people, but you're still going to have 4 white people. Like it's always going to skew majority that way anyway. Do you know what I mean? So that's why I said it needs to be more than 50%, because you're not going to include every, it's not like you're going to be like at 60% one ethnicity. You're going to say of all people of color, they're still going to be less than the white majority anyway, you know? So that was kind of the point, was that it has to skew a little bit more heavy. So everybody can kind of get more spaces, because I don't see any world where Hollywood starts like not hiring white people in any capacity. So I just think that that's always going to be the majority, no matter what, even if you're just saying that we just want to be more than 50% of all people of color. So that was just to have some clarity. I wasn't speaking for just all black people. I was speaking for all people of color. Right. So yeah.
Of course, the people who make decisions, buying decisions. Yeah. I mean, George Cheeks at CBS now is a black executive, but we haven't seen much of that at the top at all.
No, and I think that's to the point of the nomination stuff, is you're kind of asking, and to the point of what gets greenlit, to the point of what gets made, is you're still the gatekeepers and the decision makers, right? The decision makers to make a show or a movie, and the decision makers to vote on movies or TV shows are still going to be mostly white. So what you're still asking, you're still having to ask somebody who doesn't look like you or may not understand you, hey, take a second from like the easy things to watch and understand, and like look at why my art is valuable. And that's a hard position to be in, to have somebody else be determining your existence and your art to be validated. That's a very uncomfortable and a very difficult, and it requires somebody to step outside of their comfort zone. Like, that's what was ironic to me, even about the opening the Emmy votes up to 8 shows, was that the purpose was to be more inclusive of shows of color, and it just still made 7 white shows in there and 1 show of color. You know, it didn't do its job, because it still requires the voters to say, even if I say I'm going to vote for 5 that, but I'm going to vote for 3 shows I wouldn't normally consider, it still requires them to do the work, not just like, oh, well, now I can add the other white shows I want to vote for. You know what I mean?
I can add Modern Family again. Oh, no, wait, maybe it's not on the air anymore.
Right. Yeah, and so I think that's true across all things. I see it in sports where they have the Rooney Rule, which is to hire more black football coaches in the NFL. But they just kind of like now go around the Rooney Rule and say, OK, we'll do a token interview, but really we want to hire this person. So it's not actually doing the job it's intended for. So because it still requires the people that have to make decisions, make different decisions.
Prentice, you don't have a Wikipedia page. I think you should by now. I mean, I don't have one either. But I think we should.
I'm cool being off the radar. I don't need anything up there that's going to be... They always get stuff wrong anyway.
Well, sometimes. I've seen some pretty weird stuff on Wikipedia, but it can be a resource. But my point is, I haven't been able to find much about where you are from. I see you certainly labored in the vineyard here, and what's that was not a deliberate transition, but you made this movie for Netflix, Uncorked, because I think based on your experience of wanting to be a sommelier. Is this literally true?
No, that part is not true. No. No, okay. I never wanted to be a sommelier.
Because I was like, what? I read that somewhere, and I was like, you wanted to be a sommelier? Or maybe you're just a wine lover. I don't know.
Yeah, no, the only true part of that is it's based on the concept of the movie is based around myself and my father, which is my family ran a furniture store that my grandfather started. And then when my grandfather had a stroke, my father took it over, dropped out of college, took it over. And I was sort of being groomed to be next in line. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to write. And that was a thing between my father and I about why I didn't want to carry on the legacy of that. And so as I got to be a father, it made me understand him differently and understand why he was wanting that. But as a kid, I didn't really understand that. And so that's where the germ of that was. And then I changed the areas of focus based around that. But the idea of a sort of father-son story, kind of not dissimilar from Lady Bird or very slice of life. I feel like black people don't usually get to make slice of life movies like that. They're very small and kind of intimate. And so I wanted to do that, where it was just focusing on like our beauty and like not like our burden in a way. And so that's sort of where the movie came from.
Coming up after a short break, Prentice Penny tells us how he jumped at the chance to work on Insecure with Issa Rae and how the team is tackling season 5 in pandemic times. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're speaking with Prentice Penny, executive producer of HBO's Insecure. Penny got his start writing for Girlfriends, which ran for 8 seasons on UPN and The CW. On that series, he met many rising Black behind-the-camera stars, including Kenya Barris and Lena Waithe. After that, Penny worked in majority white writers' rooms on such shows as Scrubs and Happy Endings. But spending time in those rooms made him realize that he wanted to tell stories that reflected his experiences growing up in Los Angeles. And then along came Insecure.
I saw that in Deadline, the pilot got picked up to be, they were going to shoot the pilot, and that Larry had to leave as a showrunner because he had got the nightly show on Comedy Central and they were looking for a new showrunner.
That's Larry Wilmore, obviously.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. So I was like, I knew it was funny. Like, again, you don't know. I remember like my mom had told me about Issa before, because Issa and I grew up a block over from each other.
But how did your mom know about Issa?
You know how like LA Times magazine comes out like on the Sunday edition, like the small magazine.
Yes.
And my mom had read some article in there about Issa's web series and her book. And my mom is the most, she's a judge, but she's the most like non-industry person. Like my mom reads Deadline just for no reason.
I'm going to try just put in a word for the Hollywood Reporter here, but go on.
Yes. And so, absolutely. Yeah, so she's just up on industry stuff, but she just happened to read this article and she would just be like my mom calls me Prinny. She'd be like, Prinny, I just read this article about this Black girl who grew up in View Park, who's making this web series and this book and blah, blah, her name's Issa Rae. And she's like, and my mom always thinks I know everybody. So she's like, do you know her? And I would think I was the time I was like on Happy Endings. And I was like, no, mom, I don't know her, but like, good for her. And so, but that name had always stuck out to me. And so when they were looking for a showrunner, I was like, oh, this is the woman my mom was telling me about. And she's from my neighborhood and blah, blah. And I was like, well, let me, and at that time, I was like, well, let me read the script. And at the time I had been, once Girlfriends got canceled from 2008 until 2015, I had only worked in white writer rooms and I was always the only Black person. And so for 8 years, after a certain point, it just feels very isolating. And as much as I love those staffs, as much as I love those shows, as much as I love those people, I just felt like I'm tired of being the only one at a certain point. Mm-hmm. And I also want to like start just working around more Black, like one more Black person. and so
just give me one.
Yeah, just one. And just wanting to do more art that felt like it was representing me. And I felt at that point mm-hmm. I was comfortable enough in my abilities and comfortable enough in my own skin that I wanted to like start telling other narratives and do things in a cable space that you always can't do on network television. And when I read the script, it was like obviously speaking to me and speaking to a ton of obviously other people of color. And I just wanted to be like, yo, I love this. And so I just felt like I was ready to do that. And also I wanted to help. I also viewed Issa like a younger me. And I was like, if I was coming up right now and I was Issa, what would I want as like a protector and a showrunner? Like, let me be that for her. So I read the script, loved it, and met Issa, and then she and I hit it off. And when we realized that we were like lived around the corner from each other in the past, and then at that time we also lived around the corner from each other in Inglewood, so we just could speak the same language. We knew, and we were both from LA, so it was just like we just had a shorthand about what the show should be, where it should be set, the types of people it should be around. And we just were aligned creatively in terms of like wanting to make the same show. And that's really how that happened.
So I'm a huge Insecure fan.
Oh, thank you.
I'm always like watching the live tweets during the show. They get a little intense, you know, you got Team Lawrence and then poor Condola.
Oh man.
And Molly got killed this past season online. And I don't know. I mean, does that, Does that create an issue when the actors are getting, I mean, people get confused between the actors and the characters and this sort of bile pours out? Or do the actors just say, yeah, I'm killing it because I'm portraying this person who's going through a messed up situation?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, I think Christina, who plays Condola, took it more, a little bit more in stride just because this was like her first kind of like real season on the show, even though she had appeared in season three. So I think she had more fun with it, kind of being like taking the, having fun and poking fun at being like this sort of spoiler villain character, even though she was never set up that way in the beginning of the season. But I think Yvonne Orji, who plays Molly, had a harder time because she had been with the show from the beginning and people like, you know, they love Molly or they have some type of opinion, but not like, because they we never had Issa and Molly have to be facing off in some capacity. So I think she was, and I think we were all counting on people being like, yeah, I see both sides. But that is just not how it happened. So I think it shook Yvonne for a little bit, but I think now the Emmy nom is like, it's all worth it.
Yeah, I guess it is. I mean, I'm not saying I'm a super fan, but I definitely watch your show.
I love that. I love that.
How are you going to manage season five? I think you have a virtual writer's room, and I know how things are in our meetings. You can't do the asides. You can't team up with somebody on the down low and say, let's kill that idea that the other person has. It's much more awkward. Or be nice and supportive is an option. Just be negative. So how does that affect the room?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely has an impact. I think with comedy, a lot of it obviously is, you know, things happening kind of spontaneous or to a rhythm in the room or a bit that becomes a story. So you lose a lot of that stuff. So that's very hard. It's much more, it's tougher. I mean, everything takes longer. You know, if something took us a week before, it takes us almost 2 weeks or 2.5 weeks now to like figure it out. Just because we're less time on Zooms and you just don't have the energy that it has from the room. But so I'm very thankful that we have most of the same staff we've had from the beginning and the same staff from the new writers we hired last year, this year. So I can't imagine starting new with new people, how that would be. But it's definitely tough, but we're sort of finding our way as we continue and sort of allowing more time in the beginning to kind of just ease into the show. But it definitely has its challenges for sure.
Do you have a plan to shoot at some point or you don't know yet?
We do. We were supposed to shoot this year, but all that got pushed just because of everything that's happening, obviously. And we just weren't going to be ready writing wise. Like that's try to do that schedule with the way it is now was just going to be impossible. So I think we all kind of recognize that. So right now our plan is to shoot in 2021. In the first like quarter of the year, but obviously there's like three or four built-in contingencies based on whatever's right. happening in the world. But that's sort of the plan right now.
You know, I need some more. I miss my Insecure. And you have another movie for Netflix, I think. You just did this, you have this overall deal. You've directed episodes. You're doing everything.
I'm trying to. I have three kids and a wife who takes care of them. So I'm only with a job in the house. I got to do something.
Prentice Penny is a multi-hyphenate. He is the executive producer of Insecure. Thank you so much for your time.
Are you kidding me? No, thank you so much.
And that's The Business. Kevin Tidmarsh produced and edited today's program. Paul Smith mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.